Heading to CBC? Make sure to stop by booth 1989 to chat with the Brewbound team, check out our live podcast recordings, and find out about Brewbound's upcoming events. Have news to submit ahead of the show? Head to brewbound.com/submitnews to let us know about your latest updates.
Hello and welcome to episode 43 of the Brewbound podcast presented by BevNet, where we bring you interviews with some of the most well-known figures throughout the beer industry. Today is Thursday, July 4th, Independence Day. My name is Chris Frenari, and I'm joined by my co-host, Justin Kendall.
I can't believe you made me come in on the 4th of July to do this podcast with you.
I dragged you in here on the 4th of July. Our listeners definitely think that. Wait, hold on. Did you hear that?
Oh, all the fireworks.
Did you hear that? I heard something. Did you hear it? I think it was a little... Oh! It's the boss. The boss, baby. I'm getting in the spirit, Justin. I'm getting our listeners in the spirit.
Man.
I'm going to get sued if I play any more of that song.
BMI is going to come after us.
So yeah, it is Independence Day. And listen, happy birthday to America. If you're listening to us right now on the 4th of July, you either have absolutely no life, you're so drunk that you don't know what you're doing, or you forgot to turn off your iTunes playlist and now we're in your earbuds.
You fell asleep for long.
You fell asleep on the beach or something. I don't know. Or maybe you just love us that much. They love hearing our voice.
I'm sure there's one or two of them.
Okay.
And happy birthday to Dusty Rhodes.
It is your dog's birthday.
It is my dog's birthday.
And the wrestler, Dusty Rhodes.
Probably not his birthday, but it's the real dog's.
The character.
Yeah.
The character, Dusty Rhodes.
He is the American dream.
He is. Okay. So since it's 4th of July, we're going to try to keep this as brief as possible. What we've got on deck for you is obviously our interview that we teased with Nancy Palmer. We're going to do a little bit of 4th of July trivia here before we get to the news. And then we've got a couple of brief segments. Our 4th of July 4-pack is what we're calling it, where we're basically going to pick the four things each that we, you know, you have to do on 4th of July. It'll be sort of a draft style.
Wow.
So
the fantasy draft I've been waiting for.
The one that you didn't know you wanted or needed. Okay, so first up, Independence Day trivia. For Justin. Are you ready?
Why is it for me?
Because I wrote the questions and I know the answers. So now you have to answer them.
Go ahead.
Okay. Do you know why we celebrate the 4th of July? Or why do we celebrate the 4th of July?
It's the Declaration of Independence.
What about it?
And wasn't it signed on the 4th?
Okay. Well, some people signed it after, but yeah. But that's still the wrong answer. Actually, it's when Will Smith, Bill Pullman, Randy Quaid, and Jeff Goldblum saved America from a vicious alien attack. Okay, so you got that one wrong. You're 0 for 1. number 2, how old is America this year?
243 years old.
You Googled that.
No.
You Googled
1776.
It. You can't do math.
1776.
Okay. Whatever.
Come on.
We'll give that one to you. Which state was the first to declare July 4th as an official state holiday?
I'm going to go with Massachusetts.
Okay. You definitely cheated on these questions.
No, that was a total guess.
Okay. Well, you're right. Massachusetts.
It should be.
Our home state. Okay. Do you know what year for a little bonus?
Probably not.
You want to take a guess?
1777.
No, 1781. You were close. Okay, and can you name the three presidents who died on the 4th of July?
No. No, I cannot name them. Is that the correct answer?
Name three presidents who died. Do I need to do this Jeopardy style?
George.
Who are?
Who are George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Ronald Reagan?
Okay, you got one of three. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and James Monroe.
Not bad. That's better than I expected I'd get.
Yeah, that one, I mean, 33%. You missed question one, obviously. We knew that was Independence Day. Let's see. You cheated on number two. I'll give you number three, even though you get number three. So you got one out of four.
One out of four. This is bullshit.
All right, three out of four. I feel like we made our listeners a little bit smarter on 4th of July, if we did nothing else.
Now I want to go watch Independence Day.
Yeah, I mean, you should. Everybody should on 4th of July. Maybe that'll be in our four-pack. Who knows? Okay, let's read the news, shall we?
Yeah.
Why don't you take the first one? I'll do the second one, and then you take the third one.
All right. So the St. Louis brewery, maker of Schlafly beer, this week announced that Fran Caradona would take over as CEO. Caradona is a 25-year industry veteran who co-founded the Signature Beer Company, one of Schlafly's first wholesalers, as well as the O'Fallon Brewery. She assumes the role from Emily Parker Lamp, Schlafly's former head of brewing operations, who had been serving in the interim role following the departure of James Pendergraf, who resigned last December after circulating negative and misleading information about a local competitor to industry partners. Meanwhile, Parker Lamp will now serve as chief of brewery operations.
Anheuser-Busch InBev's innovation and growth unit, ZX Ventures, has acquired Swish Beverages, the makers of Babe canned wines and White Girl Rosé. Terms of the purchase were not disclosed. Swish Beverages was co-founded by internet celebrity The Fat Jew, and it sells its products in 27 states and online.
What a name that is.
That is a name.
Yes. Financially troubled Austin craft beer maker Cellus Brewery has staved off an impending closure for now. The company's assets and property were set to be sold at an auction on Tuesday, but a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing submitted this week has protected Cellus from losing its real estate and its brewing equipment. According to Monday's filing, FFBC Operations, Cellus's parent company's total debt exceeds $10 million to hundreds of creditors. Additionally, the company said it plans to pursue a sale of the assets as an ongoing concern and/or the filing of a plan of reorganization that maximizes the value of their assets and business for the benefit of creditors and equity.
And that is the latest news for this week. We have yet another update on a distressed brewery. We have an acquisition, and we have a People Moves announcement. So sort of a mixed bag, and sort of what we expect around this time of the year.
Sign of the times.
Sign of the times. It is difficult out there, and people are making moves. All right, now that we've read the news and we've made all of our listeners smarter, and they now know more about the 4th of July, let's get to our interview with Nancy Palmer. Many of our listeners will recognize Nancy for being the first woman to ever receive the Brewers Association's FX Matt Defense of the Industry Award in 2018. Others will know her simply as the person that brought Georgia's antiquated beer laws into the 21st century. For years, Nancy fought on behalf of Georgia breweries so they could sell beer directly to consumers. As a result of her dedication to that cause, in 2017, Georgia became the final state in the U.S. to allow small craft brewers to sell beer directly to drinkers via their tap rooms. Her next battle is reforming franchise laws and securing self-distribution privileges for her members. During our interview, we dive into what it takes to change state laws and get Nancy's thoughts on why franchise law reform is necessary both in Georgia and across the United States. All right, here she is, Nancy Palmer. Chris Fornari here for the Brewbound podcast, and today I'm joined by Nancy Palmer, the executive director of the Georgia Craft Brewers Guild. Nancy, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So coming up on your six-year anniversary, actually, of being named the executive director of the Guild, what have you learned over the last 6 years, and what's that ride been like?
Well, you've got to love an industry where you do something for 6 years and you're practically ancient, right? It's been kind of a wild ride. It's been a lot of fun getting to know the other Guild executive directors that have been with me during this time. You know, Paul from New York and Rob from Arizona, like Tom from California. We have kind of an OG crew of executive directors. That's a lot of fun to get to know. And we've really kind of come up together in figuring out how to do this. Acacia Coast at the Brewers Association would know better than me, but I think when I became the ED, I might have been like the 15th or 16th maybe, and now we're over 50 if you count regional guilds.
Yeah.
So the role of executive director has become very popular across the United States.
Yeah, and it seems like it's a position, too, where there's not a whole lot of turnover, like you said, like you've kind of grown up with these people.
Yeah, it's interesting. We really have kind of stuck with it. We definitely have guilds who have added on staff. Georgia's not one of them yet, but it has been like a pretty standard crew of people. And I think some of it's because we get along so well. Some of it's because there's a camaraderie. Not everyone understands what our job is. And so I think being able to get to know each other and have that support has actually kind of led to a little bit of longevity. And then the Brewers Association support and their consistency through the last 6 years has been really incredible.
Yeah. So maybe for some of our listeners who aren't as familiar with, you know, your sort of primary responsibilities as a guild leader, maybe help them understand, you know, what it is you sort of do day to day, what your primary goals and objectives are, and, you know, how that might differ from some of the other guild leaders across the country.
Yeah, definitely. So the guild leaders tend, we kind of all have end up having different roles. Every state guild is a state trade association or a business league. So we're all set up to advocate on behalf of the businesses that we represent. The vast majority of us have both breweries and brew pubs in our organizations. And though we might have slightly different definitions of what a craft brewery is from state to state. And each state's totally different in what they need. You know, we have some states that really focus on events. We have other states that really focus on marketing. Thinking about New York, the Think and Why, Drink and Why campaign is a huge thing that their state guild has worked on. For us in Georgia, there's a lot of focus on legislation and regulatory intervening. So for me and my organization, I'd say probably a number one thing that my members find valuable is our legislative initiatives. And then number two is working with regulators to intervene when there's new regulation and try to bring the industry and the regulators together to find some common ground. Sometimes it's just intervening with regulators. You know, I'll have a brewer that has a bad run-in with the Department of Agriculture, and so I'll be able to call the DOA boss and work it out kind of top down, as opposed to, you know, my brewers kind of getting in fights with regulatory agencies. So I think those are the two things that I do that my members found the most valuable, but it can be totally different in different states. It's just about where that state is with their laws and what they need.
Yeah. Well, when one of the, you know, sort of most notable things that you've done as the guild is, you know, kind of on the policy side, helping Georgia brewers, you know, basically have direct sales laws in their favor. It was SB 85?
Yeah, Senate Bill 85. I kept on calling it Ocho Cinco.
I like that.
I'm a Chad Johnson fan. What are you going to do?
I like that. SB 85. And we're actually coming up on the two-year anniversary of that going into effect. It was, what, I think late August or early September when brewers in Georgia actually had the ability to sell directly to customers in a bona fide way.
Yeah. So it was September 1st, 2017, and that's when the law went into effect, and it allowed breweries to sell beer direct to the public up to 3,000 barrels a year and up to one case per person per day to go that's included in that 3,000 barrel cap, which I'm sure for some people listening, they might think there's a cap at all on the total sales or on the to-go sales, but that's the negotiation. That's where we landed.
Definitely not our listeners in Texas.
Right. They're very excited about the idea of one case per person per day.
Yeah.
And what we were able to do is get that law passed with our wholesalers. It took a lot of negotiation to kind of bring them along, but it went through relatively smoothly once we had come to an agreement. And we were the dead last state to do it. So Mississippi and Georgia passed similar laws at the same time, and theirs went into effect in July. So that delay to September just killed us.
Yeah.
But it's been very exciting for our breweries. We're talking about a tremendous growth in the industry and certainly a growth in capital investment. A lot of our breweries have opened second locations in order to take better advantage of the retail. We've had many breweries open. New Realm's a great example that was built around this direct-to-consumer model that's brand new. I mean, it's just been a total game changer for the industry. And I think the consumers took a moment to catch up because they were used to our crazy system before.
And for our listeners, that crazy system was like, you know, you feign going on a tour and you pay $5 and then there's two beers or something at the end. I mean, brewers came up with all sorts of crazy ways to find a loophole.
Yeah. So we were able to sell educational tours that could come with some amount of free beer. And even that went through some iterations in my time at running the guild. And I think actually the fact that that system was so confusing and such a kind of weird loophole system is what ultimately helped us win the argument of like, how about we just cut the crap and we just sell the beer? Just, you know, money, beer, very simple transaction most people are used to. I think that going through all those awkward phases helped us make the argument that we were ready to just sell beer.
Malt Europe Malting Company is North American proud with premium grains from field to flavor. Our selections include base, specialty, and distillers malt varieties. Stop by our booth, 2143, at the Craft Brewers Conference in Vegas. Does your brewing software suck? We've heard it from thousands of brewers. Connect with Ollie today and we'll buy out your current contract and hook you up with brewing software that doesn't suck. Visit booth 1685 at CBC or hit getollie.com/pod.
But while you were going through all those awkward phases, were you personally like still trying to accomplish the eventual goal of direct to consumer sales? Like, were you having those conversations with the wholesaler trade groups and pushing for that, you know, that whole time?
Absolutely. We were, and we tried a couple of different tactics when it came to negotiation and who we were talking to and who we were using as sponsors. We always had the goal of getting direct to consumer sales. And we had a bill in 2015, SB 63, that would have done it, but it got whittled down during the legislative process to back to the educational tour thing. We were able to give away more free beer, but it still had to be free. So, you know, that was always our goal, and it took those little steps for us to kind of get to a place where we could do the sales. And where I found the biggest gain was that we put three of our business owners and three of the Georgia wholesaler business owners in a room, and I wasn't in there, and our lobbyists weren't in there, and their executive director and their lobbyists weren't in there. It was just the business owners, and that's really what produced the outcome that everybody was comfortable with, and it made life a lot easier when there weren't kind of people like me who might have a few too many questions in the room, and they were able to just kind of negotiate it out, and that actually worked out really well.
So getting out of the way is sometimes a tactic for guild leaders when it comes to policymaking.
Absolutely. And it's because kind of, to a certain extent, the people who represent the wholesalers, it's their job to say no. I mean, that's really very much their job, is to say no. But when you have the brewers and the owners in the same room, they already have a working relationship. They're exchanging money and product every single day.
Right.
So it's just a little easier for them to have a conversation and not go to their corners than it is for me and the executive director of the Wholesalers Association. I feel very confident that my members always gave me full room to negotiate, but I don't feel like the Wholesalers Association had full room to negotiate. We had to bring the business owners in order to get that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's certainly been, as you sort of described, like a pretty big boon for the brewers down there. What specifically have you noticed change? Like, have you seen a sharp increase in the number of breweries that have opened? Like, what are we talking about from August 31st, 2017 to now?
So we've seen a lot of businesses open, and then that direct investment in tap rooms and second locations was a big thing. Initially, for that first, I would say 6 months, 8 months, even a year, there was a lot of transition time for my brewers and for the consumer, because the consumer had created the brewery experience as like a unique thing that you only do like once a month, and you've got to like only be there for the 2 hours they're open. You know, it was like a special event. And so we had to retrain the consumer that this is going to feel and act a whole lot more like just a regular bar that you might go to like you know, multiple times a week.
Right.
So retraining the consumer, and sometimes the consumer was kind of upset that beer was now, they had to pay money for it as opposed to go on this like weird tour thing. So retraining the consumer was a process. Retraining the breweries was a process because many of them had never invested in a tap room. They didn't necessarily have bartenders. They didn't know how to keep a tab open. They didn't have POS systems necessarily. They certainly weren't open, you know, 10 hours a day, that kind of thing. And so a lot of those second locations came from a place of the tap rooms and original locations being set up to operate like 6 hours a week,
right,
instead of 40 hours a week or something like that. And that was a big change. You know, a lot of the tap rooms were also like staging areas for shipments and, you know, actual production areas for mobile canning lines, as opposed to places that needed to be open to the public regularly.
Yeah, they weren't designed to be retail focused.
Exactly. So that's where a lot of the second location business came in for breweries that were already established in Atlanta. We've seen some breweries open with a tap room focused model, but not nearly as many as we're seeing across the United States. So I think Bart Watson would tell you about 75% of breweries in the country make about 75% or more of their money on site. We have very few of those in Georgia.
Why do you think that is, despite the fact that they have the ability to sell direct now?
I'm not entirely sure. I think some of it is that breweries in Georgia see other breweries in Georgia. And so if the whole first crop of breweries, let's say our first 50, were all built for forced distribution, 100% scale up or, you know, go big or go home,
mm-hmm.
then I think maybe other brewery owners kind of see that and that's their vision of what a brewery is, when in the reality of what's going on in the rest of the country, that's not what a brewery is anymore. So I've seen as many breweries open with 20-barrel brew houses as I've seen with, you know, 5-barrel brew houses or 10-barrel brew houses. And so we're still seeing kind of larger breweries than average in Georgia. We're the 17th largest manufacturer of craft beer, but we still rank 50th in breweries per capita. So our breweries are really quite big.
Yeah.
And I think that we're going to start trending towards those smaller taproom-focused breweries, but that transition's been slower than I expected.
How many breweries are there in Georgia now?
According to our Department of Revenue, there's 93. According to the Brewers Association, there's 82. According to me, I'd say there's 65 that are businesses that have a primary financial focus in making beer. We've got, you know, some brew pubs that have small systems that never distribute and it's not a primary.
Gotcha.
So for me, I'd say there's 65 or 70 that are true blue brewing businesses where if they weren't brewing, that'd be a significant part of their income out the door.
Yeah. How about for members of the guild?
So right now we're sitting at 63. And we're actually, one conversation we have amongst guild executive directors, and a little PSA to anyone who's listening, please pay your guild dues. Like, it's like pulling teeth sometimes. I know that guilds, so often we're kind of like insurance companies, like we're never anyone's number one priority, particularly when they're running a small business. And so sometimes getting attention is difficult until they need us, in which case we're always on call. But I think that sometimes getting people to kind of focus and really invest in their guilds can be a little challenging.
Well, especially now. I mean, I feel like it's so competitive out there. There's over 7,400 breweries in the United States, and craft sales are slowing. Overall beer sales are down. So, you know, that's probably like not their primary focus. If you're a brewery owner, your primary focus is figuring out like how to make your business successful, not like, oh, what can I, you know, think about changing in terms of laws today?
I think you're probably right about that. It's very difficult to focus on some of the big picture stuff when you're so focused on, like, did I buy toilet paper? And, like, why is this employee being a jerk? And you know, just stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I think that as guild leaders, we work really hard at trying to demonstrate ROI. And I don't think that many people disagree that we're doing good jobs and that what we're doing is very important. I think that it's just about kind of getting to the top of their mind for, you know, a few hours every few months to remind them that they are using all of the things that we've done right now and that we're here to support them as they grow in their business. So for me, I definitely, you know, I always take the call if there's an inspector on site. Doesn't matter, FDA, DOL, OSHA, you can put me on the phone with them. I can talk the inspector through what they should be looking for, talk the brewer through what they should be looking for, what their rights are in that situation. That's something that I think is really valuable, but it only comes up every once in a while. And so when people need that, they're super excited. But then 7 months later, when I need dues payment.
You're like, listen, I'd really like to make rent this month. Can you please pay your dues?
Can you please pay your dues? We've got bills to pay.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is just difficult. I think that's just the nature of any trade association, though. You could either put it as luckily maybe for the guild, but unfortunately for Georgia, we do have some big fights. 91% of craft breweries in the country have access to self-distribution, and none of those are in Georgia. We don't have any self-distribution. That's something that we have to look at and that we are looking at right now with legislation that we proposed at the end of the session in 2019. So we are looking at franchise law reform. We're looking at self-distribution. That's stuff that the brewers in Georgia actually do need in order to stay competitive.
So there's absolutely no form of self-distribution beyond what brewers are able to sell direct, basically.
Right.
And what, you know, is currently in the proposed piece of legislation? Like, what are you trying to accomplish for your members?
So we've got two parts. The first is franchise law reform, which I've got to come up with a better name than. I think most people who listen to this podcast probably know what I'm talking about, but it doesn't sound cool. And legislators definitely don't understand what I'm saying. But we're looking at a franchise law carve out so that a brewer can leave their wholesaler and then they can go to a successor wholesaler and they just have 30 days notice. They say, antecedent wholesaler, I'm leaving you. Successor wholesaler, I'm coming to you. In 30 days, the brand is transferred. And then the successor wholesaler and the antecedent wholesaler figure out a price.
Some fair market value.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
But the brand moves at 30 days so that the wholesaler that's being left can't just kind of tie it up for forever.
Yep.
So you've got 30 days to figure it out or it goes to arbitration, but the brand moves either way.
And is there some sort of barrel cap on who can take advantage of this?
So we're looking at a percentage cap, and that's really what we have to talk to our wholesalers about, what percentage makes sense. We're proposing 15%, and that would cover all of the breweries in the state and many of the breweries outside of the state.
So if you're less than 15% of a wholesaler's business, you would be able to transfer.
Right.
Gotcha.
Exactly. And then the second part of this is that a brewer would be able to name itself as a successor wholesaler. So in that system, if you're able to leave, then you're also able to name yourself as a successor as opposed to naming another Georgia wholesaler as your successor wholesaler.
Gotcha.
And then you would get your brands back within 30 days and you would have to compensate your wholesaler that you've left. And that self-distribution would go up to 25,000 barrels is what we're looking at right now, though with North Carolina recently going up to 50,000 and that really being the state that we're looking to when we're talking about competition and we're talking about keeping up, we might need more than 25,000.
Yeah.
Or else we're going to be in the same position that a lot of states are in where we just come back and ask for more later.
Exactly. So it sounds like you're kind of almost backdooring your way into the self-distribution piece. And it's like, hey, franchise law reform is our primary goal. And if brewers have the ability to name themselves as the successor wholesaler, well then, oh, by the way, they're going to need the right to self-distribute.
I would actually say it's kind of the reverse, and it's because I think that self-distribution is financially important to a lot of our brewers, but in order to do self-distribution, we have to have some mechanism to get our brands back from the wholesalers that currently have them.
Gotcha.
Or else it would only apply to brewers that come up in the future.
Right.
Which I have very generous members, but I don't think they're willing to invest in a very expensive political and legal fight in order to benefit only the next group of people. So in order to get that self-distribution, we've got to find some mechanism for brands to be recalled or pulled back or moved from the wholesalers that they're already with. And so that's, I would say, kind of the bigger focus is the self-distribution, and then the franchises are mechanism for getting there so that everyone can take advantage.
So hypothetically, let's say your peers on the wholesaler side, mm-hmm, say, we're okay with self-distribution, but this franchise law reform stuff is not going to fly, because that's usually the sticking point for wholesalers is, mm-hmm, they're very unwilling to negotiate any sort of carve out for franchise law. And we're starting to see that change, but it's been, you know, years in the making in many cases.
Yeah, just ask Massachusetts.
I know all about that for sure. So if they were to say, listen, we're totally cool with some sort of self-distribution thing, how would you handle that situation knowing that you might have to concede on the franchise law piece?
So we're speaking hypothetically here, but I would, I mean, kind of bottom line, that kind of negotiation would likely come out of the exact same thing that we talked about with tasting rooms, which would be three of my guys in a room, three of their guys in a room. And if they come out of the room and tell me this is what we're doing, then that's what we're doing. That's right. My job.
Yep.
My only kind of concern would come from like kind of some wonky legal perspectives where self-distribution's great, but it's not going to work unless we can give it to the breweries that currently exist.
And how many breweries do you think would even want to take on that self-distribution? I mean, we couldn't be talking about many.
Yeah, I wouldn't think many at all. Like once you've kind of set up a distribution arrangement and you've got an agreement and you've got a system and process, like it's very unlikely that many brands would want to bring back their brands and start all over again. And, you know, like that's really a challenge. And a lot of retailers at a certain scale just don't want to deal with some, you know, incredibly large number of distributors. So I think some brands that have really small footprint distribution anyways, certainly some of our rural brands, because, you know, what we have is a brewery's 100 miles from the nearest warehouse. And so a wholesaler sends a truck up and then puts 8 kegs on it and then drives it back down to the warehouse where it sits for a week and drives back up 100 miles just to be delivered to the 5 stores that are, you know, right around it.
Right.
That kind of rural distribution, I think, would see a lot of that changeover, but they're really small-scale type things.
And I can't imagine the wholesalers would be all that...
I can't imagine they're making money.
Yeah.
Doing this, like, kind of small-scale rural distribution stuff.
Yeah, they can't be all that interested in continuing to pursue those kinds of business opportunities, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that the wholesalers see what we see, which is that portfolios are getting more and more and more crowded. The number of SKUs in a wholesaler's portfolio has, like, quintupled in the last 20 years. Like, it's just, it's a lot to keep up with. And I think that there's probably some smaller brands where it'd be better for the brand and it'd be better for the wholesaler if they were able to take care of themselves. I think for some of our larger breweries, they might be able to use the self-distribution law to provide kind of better customer service to physically near locations or be able to, you know, hotshot a keg over to a charitable event or something like that.
Yeah.
That would be more the use that a larger brewery would have, established brewery would have.
If you think about, just kind of remove the Georgia lens for a moment, mm-hmm. and think about franchise law reform, you know, from a sort of national perspective,
yeah.
you know, I guess in your opinion, why or why not do these laws need to be reformed across the country to sort of match the environment that we're existing in now in beer, where there's 7,400 breweries and fewer distributors, which is sort of a flip of what it was years ago?
Yeah, and it really is that scaling that is flipped, right? And I have to give the wholesalers credit. What they would say is, yeah, we've got 7,400 breweries right now, guys. The system worked.
Yeah.
Like, we went from 40 to, you know, 7,500 during this franchise law system. Because you can kind of see that the wholesalers, with the top-down initiative, went state by state and passed these laws, mostly from the late 70s to the early 80s. And it happened in the vast, vast majority of states. I think, you know, 4 or 5 states dodged it. But this was to pass these kind of very strict franchise law reforms franchise law in the first place happened in Georgia in 1983, but you see 1981, 1980, 1984 all across the country. And that's a response to there being like 42 breweries in the United States.
Right.
And small wholesalers feel like they're bringing a knife to a gunfight when they're going up against these big brands and trying to say what they need as their wholesalers. And so we put protections in place, and then a lot of craft breweries came along. And I think that many wholesalers would say, thanks to the whole franchise system and the franchise laws across the country, all these breweries got to come along. But the reality is we're still caught in the crosshairs. We're treated the exact same way as Anheuser-Busch. And when we don't have the same power and we don't have the same intentions and we don't have the same ownership structure, there's kind of not many things that make us similar to Anheuser-Busch from a wholesaler relations standpoint, but we're still caught in that system.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like a small brewery certainly doesn't have the leverage that a, you know, international conglomerate like AB InBev does.
Right.
And they don't have the programs in place to support their brands like an AB InBev does. They don't mm-hmm. have the clout at retail to be able to category captain things and, you know, set
Absolutely.
Set shelves. So from that perspective, I mean, it makes total sense why, you know, there needs to be some sort of reform here. But, you know, I think the fear has always been that, you know, be careful what you wish for type of thing. If you open the door slightly, you might be opening the door to some things that were unintended.
Yeah, and we hear that a lot from our wholesalers that we should be very concerned about unintended consequences. We should be concerned about increased competition. We should be concerned about increased market access for big brewers. And that one's a kind of a difficult one to thread because we, at some level, like craft brewers have to choose our own destiny. We make our own choices. And even though the wholesalers think that we should be afraid of certain things, that doesn't necessarily mean that we should be afraid of them. And furthermore, it's not the wholesalers' jobs to protect us. It's our job, right? So kind of if we're going to open a door, then yeah, we're going to open a door. And that's what we think is what's best for our industry. So oftentimes, you know, I definitely hear from wholesalers, and I think at the national level, we hear from wholesalers, we're just trying to help you out. We're just trying to protect you. We're just trying to use our, you know, multi-decade experience to explain to you guys without multi-decade experience
right.
how this really works.
Right.
And I think for us, you know, we can appreciate that guidance, but also I think our fresh perspective.
And then, of course, whenever there is a compromise that you guys settle on, mm-hmm. it's the wholesalers that are allowing brewers to have
There's
some sort of carve-out.
There's usually a vibe of a paternalistic, we'll do this for you, we'll allow you to have this thing. Yeah, I think that's just kind of habit more than anything else, but it's definitely, there's an overtone, yes.
So we've seen some franchise reform in states like, I think you mentioned North Carolina, Maryland, and New York as well. I guess long term, where do you see this all playing out in states that are, you know, trying to accomplish similar things?
I mean, I'd like to think that everyone kind of keeps on moving forward. The big things are always retail sales, self-distribution and franchise law. That's the big three. There's also kind of direct shipping. That's an interesting one. I think that there's just several things that can happen that will kind of continue to create opportunities for breweries. And I think that most states will continue to move towards more and more liberal laws that support small brewers and craft brewers. I think that that's almost inevitable as small brewers and craft brewers are kind of reaching an inflection point where we have more employees than wholesalers. We have more local connections. We're in more congressional districts and that kind of thing. So I think that our political power and our market power is increasing, and naturally laws will start to move our direction.
Very nice. Well, this has been a real pleasure. You know,
it always is.
You know this stuff like the back of your hand, and Georgia is very lucky to have you. And yeah, looking forward to seeing what comes of your latest legislative efforts. Do you have a timeline on when we'll know more?
So we have proposed legislation that's still kind of floating in the ether. We're in the off season of our session. So our session starts the second Monday of January in 2020. And we'll hopefully have something by then. I mean, at minimum, we'll know whether or not the wholesalers are happy or mad. We'll definitely know that much by then.
Well,
and I'll keep you abreast of everything that happens. Check out brewbound.com for all the hot news.
Look at this. Look at this plug. I didn't even pay her.
For all the hot news on Georgia beer laws. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's going to be an interesting to watch. It was interesting to watch the taproom stuff play out. And, you know, as you start to piece this whole thing together, thinking about franchise law reform in other states and self-distribution opportunities mm-hmm. in other states, you know, Georgia's obviously a place to watch, so we'll be paying attention.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Well, thanks for joining. Cheers.
Cheers.
All right, that was our interview with Nancy Palmer, and I can think of no better way to celebrate the 4th of July than talking about franchise laws. I don't know about you, Justin. It is the most American thing I can think of.
Crack open some beers, let's get some brats going, and let's talk some franchise laws.
I mean, I feel like a lot of what she said is, at this point, it has to be common sense, right? But yet, we're still in a situation where places like Georgia, and maybe this will change, but they just haven't seen the light.
I'm sure there are other places, but Georgia especially being among the most antiquated, Texas is catching up.
Yep.
Some.
Yeah, well, they just approved direct sales from manufacturing breweries in Texas, as we know. We've seen franchise law reform roll in other states like North Carolina, Maryland. So it's starting to happen. Obviously, New York was, you know, kind of one of the first places years ago. Mm-hmm. There's ongoing discussions in Massachusetts about what that might look like here. So I feel like slowly but surely, we're going to start to see these laws reformed. But I really liked what Nancy had to say about kind of the way to get that done is sometimes just actually just like removing yourself from the conversation altogether as a guild leader.
Yeah, I think it's an important role she plays, obviously, sort of being a buffer. But you're right. Being able to step back, get some brewers in the room, get the wholesalers in the room, and let them hash it out, that's where the action's going to take place.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in many cases you have individuals in, you know, Nancy's role, whether it's a brewery state guild or a wholesaler guild, and those people sitting in the room are kind of like the parents at a parent-teacher conference. And, you know, sometimes you want to just have a direct conversation and, you know, maybe try to sit the kid down and, you know, just say, hey, look, you really need to improve in these areas. And it's just teacher to student type of thing. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you know, it's not the perfect analogy because you want to see wholesalers and brewers as equals and peers and partners and all that.
Not the paternal relationship that we so often hear about.
Exactly. And we touched on that in the interview. But at the same time, it's like there can be this feeling like the lobbyists in this case are going to try to get something over on the other party. And yeah, I mean, sometimes all that's required is, you know, just stepping out of the room, letting them have a beer, and then they walk out and say, hey, we've got a fair deal that we think everybody agrees to. Can you work it up and, you know, the legalese that you need to have, and let's move forward.
Yeah, and I'm sure that she still has eyes on it at the end and is telling them, no, this part is a very bad deal for you, if it is a very bad deal, or this is a great deal for you. So I think that needs to still be part of the process. You know, you still need that person there to be like, hey, nah, this is not in your best interest.
Right. And her primary responsibility, you know, in addition to hearing out what her members want and, you know, starting to cobble together something that would look like a bill, is going and finding somebody to actually support the bill, right? Mm-hmm. So somebody needs to write it. I mean, they can't write bills. So some state lawmaker actually has to write it. She can obviously help and kind of get the wheels turning. And any state guild, you know, leader can do that on the brewery side or the wholesaler side or the retailer side, right? Anybody can work these things up, but they still have to get support.
100%.
So, it's important to kind of make that fact known. It's not like, you know, Nancy or anyone else is like writing these laws. They are behind the scenes, mm-hmm. you know, drafting up most of this legislation and then, you know, turning it over. And that's where it starts to get refined.
Yeah, you got to have somebody to run the thing for you.
Exactly. They're the quarterbacks and, you know, the lawmakers are the running backs, just kind of putting it in the end zone.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, she plays an important role, but her role in Georgia differs from, I don't know, somewhere like maybe even California, for instance, right? Which has pretty favorable laws. Now, Tom McCormick out there does a great job of staying on top of all the various, you know, legislative matters that arise each and every year. But for the most part, he needs to be more of a cheerleader for the industry. And he plays defense more than offense.
And you can do that when you're more established like he is.
Right.
He's been there for forever.
Yeah, you know? And he's been in the industry forever.
Exactly. And they do have the favorable laws, so it is easier to play defense. And it is, it's probably not easy, but playing from a defensive position is going to be a lot better when you've already got something.
Right. It's always easier to defend your turf than to go and try to change things, as we've seen.
And then you've got Nancy who's, you know, pushing a boulder up a hill.
Yeah, literally telling people in Georgia, like, this is not the way it functions in 49 other states. Like, we need to get with the times.
So every state's going to be unique, too. You know, what works in Georgia isn't going to work in California. Or, I mean, it might, but it's probably not going to fly the same way. Same thing goes for Texas.
So thinking about the franchise law reform stuff for a minute, obviously, we know that a lot of states are taking a look at that, examining it. Some states have already moved on it. Where do you kind of see all of it going over the next few years? Like, do you think we'll see a place like Massachusetts, for instance, or a place like, let's just use Georgia, either of those two states, which historically have been difficult places to strike a deal on really anything related to any sort of self-distribution or wholesale laws that would lean in favor of brewers. Do you think we'll see something happen in the next couple of years?
Honestly, I think it depends on which brewers you have in each of those states. So if you've got somebody who is a larger brewer who's not going to fall within something that would work for 99% of the breweries in your state, that could essentially derail it unless they're going to be altruistic.
Yeah. I mean, I think in Georgia, there's really only a couple of brewers that would maybe fall outside of any, you know, sort of compromise that I think they'd be able to come up with. Just kind of basing it off of what we've seen in other states. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at like Sweetwater, right?
Massachusetts is such a harder state too, because you've got Boston Beer and then you've got a whole slew of breweries below it who are increasingly exceeding whatever caps are already sort of being thrown out there as part of these like agreements that are being put forth.
Yeah, we're seeing anywhere from, you know, 30 to 60,000 barrels in a lot of cases. And like New York is like 300,000. Yeah, so there's varying degrees. And usually there's a percentage of a wholesaler's business. So there's a model that most states are following. But yeah, I think you're right. It does depend on, you know, who the largest brewers are in that state. Honestly, a lot of it depends on the brewers that are distributing in that state too, mm-hmm. because this impacts, it's important to remember, it impacts not only the brewers that live in that state and operate in that state, but the ones that sell beer in that state too. So if you're New Belgium or Yingling or Sierra Nevada, you could potentially be taking advantage of some of these franchise law provisions as well.
That's a big take advantage too.
Yeah. So I think that's obviously the fear or the concern from the wholesale side. But the bottom line is it's flipped. We have fewer wholesalers now and more brewers. And I think it's time that everybody kind of takes a look at it and says, we can't sell all this beer. We don't want to sell all this beer anyways. So let's find a modern approach to this whole three-tier system that doesn't destruct everything and allows a small rural brewery, like Nancy said, to deliver kegs around town while still maintaining the integrity of a system that, you know, clearly has worked and has its benefits.
They can't be making money on some of this beer, right? From the smaller producers having to pick it up, truck it so far, and then truck it back. It just can't be cost efficient.
No, and it doesn't make financial sense. It doesn't make logistics sense. It doesn't make environmental sense. Like, there are so many reasons why they should consider, you know, allowing these sorts of privileges to pass through. And so maybe we'll do the same thing. Praying hands emoji for Georgia. We did praying hands emoji for Texas and it worked. So we'll try it again. Praying hands emoji for Georgia. And then we'll get to Massachusetts later, because I don't think it's happening in Massachusetts anytime soon.
We may be the last to the table there.
Yeah, we might be the Georgia of franchise laws. If Georgia passes franchise laws before Massachusetts, then we might have a problem.
Massachusetts, it's got to be a game of just like you're swatting flies left and right. You know, it's like they're coming for the beer gardens, you know, and we're fighting franchise law reform and we want farm brewery stuff. You know, like there's so many different fronts to fight.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. Well, that was a great conversation, as always, with Nancy. If you guys want to get in touch with her, just go on the Georgia Brewers Guild website. She's usually pretty open, willing to offer advice, suggestions. If you're a state guild leader out there that, you know, wants to figure out strategies or tactics for doing any of this stuff, she's always super open to sharing that stuff. So find her on the internet and reach out. In the meantime, we're just about to get out of here and go blow ourselves up with some fireworks. But our 4th of July 4-pack.
All right. How's this work?
So you're essentially drafting things that you like want to do or you would do or must do's on 4th of July. Your 4th of July activity pack, but it's a 4-pack.
All right. I'll let you go first.
You're going to let me go first?
I will let you go first.
You don't want to Rochambeau for it?
No.
I feel like Rochambeauing would be a very American thing to do.
Nah, I'm feeling giving.
Wow.
Listen to Justin turning over a new leaf. It must be the Macho Man Randy Savage t-shirt you're wearing today.
It probably is.
You've snapped into a Slim Jim. Okay.
That was going to be my first pick. Now you have to take Slim Jims.
Okay. My first pick. Hold on. I wrote these down. Let me get to the... let's see here. Okay. Maybe I shouldn't go with my first pick. No, I got to stick with my first pick. Okay. I teased it at the beginning. I'm going to say plan Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA. Like, if you don't play Born in the USA or just a whole, like, mess of boss tracks, you're not American. I mean, that is the most American thing I can think of. Born in the USA, Born to Run. He was born to do a lot of things. And I was born to play his music on the 4th of July.
Dance in the Dark. And
yeah, Glory Days, Dancing in the Dark.
Mm-hmm.
All of them. All the hits. Just all play the hits.
Badlands.
So that's my number one.
That's pretty good one, number one. I'm going to take Summer Blockbuster.
Like go see one?
Yeah.
You go see it on 4th of July?
Like 4th of July weekend. Okay. Somewhere in there.
Okay. Okay, so we're extending throughout the weekend.
Yeah.
Just so we know.
Yeah.
Okay. So what would be like your summer blockbuster? Obviously, Independence Day was one.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's out. I know we're going to go see Midsommar.
Okay.
It's a horror movie, so of course.
All-time summer blockbusters?
Probably Independence Day. That's probably my favorite one of the genre.
Okay, next week we'll do another four-pack of all-time summer blockbusters.
Okay.
All right. Let's see... Number two, I'm going to go with, you know, lighten up the grill. You got to light up the grill on 4th of July. It's not an American day without a little propane, a little charcoal, however, a little wood, however you grill your meats, however you cook up your brats, your burgers, your veggies, your grilled corn. You got to fire up that grill.
That's a good one. Yeah, I need a grill. I need a place that isn't a studio apartment, too. So I'm going to go with burgers. I want to eat all the burgers.
So go to a party that has burgers or pick burgers up or...
Just any type of...
You got to eat a burger.
Yeah, a good one, too. Like a good, juicy burger.
All right.
We're not fast-fooding it.
All right, so you're seeing a blockbuster, you're eating a burger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm playing Born to Run and Born in the USA and firing up the grill.
Getting fat is apparently also on mine.
Let's see here. You know, I'm going to go ahead for number three and say, I'm going to go a little off script here, and I'm going to say playing catch. A nice game of catch. You know, bust out the mitt. I mean, baseball is America's pastime, and I feel like if you can find yourself in a situation where there's a large lawn area, or maybe you're at a park, like, you got to play a game of catch.
Yeah.
Now, I will extend it to, you know, maybe throw the football around, throw the frisbee around. But you got to throw something through the air for a while.
Okay. I could do that. I think I'm going to have to, which should have been the number one pick. I feel really bad that it wasn't the number one pick. I'm going to drink some beer.
Oh, all right. I mean, I feel like that was a given.
It seems like a given, but I think it's up for grabs in this draft, right?
I mean, it is. I had that on my list. I had it a little bit different, so we'll do
some.
You're
going to drink some seltzer?
Well, no. God, no. Actually, I probably will end up drinking some seltzer. We'll get to some honorable mentions later. All right, so you're drinking beer. You're seeing a movie. You're having a burger. Man, you're having a good fourth. All right, I'm going to go with lighting off some bootleg fireworks. You know, the ones that were assembled in Mexico or China, or they're usually China, I think. Although, are those getting tariffed? Is the cost of lighting things on fire this year more expensive because of the Trump tariffs?
I believe it would be. I think that the tariffs on China are still on, and that's for all goods, right?
Well, I mean, listen, there's nothing more American than buying something from overseas, especially from China, and sending it up into the air and blowing it up, especially the ones that have like a 50% chance of blowing up on you while you light it. I mean, if you're not taking your life in your hands on 4th of July, are you even really living?
I think you are. I don't think anybody wants to be like Jason Pierre-Paul and have a messed up hand after getting it blown off.
Listen, if you live in Massachusetts, you know, you make that drive over the border to New Hampshire, you hit the Phantom fireworks stand, you buy like $300 worth of fireworks, and you just go to town. So for my fourth and final four-pack pick, it's bootleg fireworks.
I guess I'm going to have to take a Thunder shirt.
Excuse me?
A Thunder shirt.
Like a Thunder Buddies?
Yeah, Thunder Buddies, man. You got to take care of your Thunder Buddy, because while you're setting off bootleg fireworks, my dog here is going to be like, the world is ending.
Okay.
And he will need a Thunder shirt. And so that will be my fourth pick, is a Thunder shirt.
Yeah, you got to watch out for the dogs on 4th of July. They don't like the fireworks, that's for sure. So I appreciate that. Sentimental Justin here. Mm-hmm. All right, run it back. I'm playing the boss. I'm grilling out. I'm lighting off bootleg fireworks. And I am playing some catch.
I'm seeing a movie. I'm eating burgers, drinking beers, and taking care of the dog with a Thunder shirt.
We're having very American 4th of July's.
USA. USA.
Bam, 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 bam. Okay, honorable mention for me, buying an Old Navy flag t-shirt.
Mm.
I think, you know, it's very nostalgic. As a kid, I would always go to Old Navy, buy a flag t-shirt. So I'd like to maybe bring that tradition back at some point.
Mine would be...
But not the flag, not the Betsy Ross flag, all right? Just want to make it clear. Not the Betsy Ross flag.
Mine would be watching noted friend of Melvin Brewing, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, beat some people up. Ho!
Okay. Okay, that's a good honorable mention. I'm going to go with another one. Smoking a cigar was on my list. I feel like that's a very American thing to do. Smoke a cigar at the end of the night. You've had a few too many beers. You're, you know, looking for a little nightcap. Smoke a cigar was an honorable mention for me.
That's not bad.
So, any more honorable mentions?
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be anywhere near a pool.
Maybe watching the Boston Pops.
Yeah, maybe the Boston Pops. Probably.
Listening to NPR, catching the Boston Pops on NPR.
Yeah, taking a break from some Murder, She Wrote.
All right. Well, happy 4th of July, everyone. And one final segment, buy him a beer.
Yeah.
This is a Justin special.
This is. I used to live in Kansas City for, I think it was 11 years. And I started writing about beer at the end. And... I got to know Jeremy Danner from Boulevard. He was the ambassador brewer there. He was let go last week. And I'd like to buy Jeremy a beer because he was always good to me. He's knowledgeable. He's a beer Twitter fixture. That guy's going to land on his feet, I'm sure, at another brewery somewhere. But until then, buy Jeremy Danner a beer.
Yeah. And what do you think will happen with the Dannering? Do you know Dannering?
No. What is a Dannering?
Oh, come on. You cannot be a Dannerite and not know Dannering. I don't know if that's a Dannerite. I might have just made something up. Dannering is where you get that like emergency seat on the plane that has he takes photos of his feet.
Oh, I have seen that. Yes.
Okay. So do you think the Dannering tradition will continue? Is that something that like transcends his time at Boulevard?
I think that does.
That's in the lexicon now.
Yeah.
If you're Dannering.
In the beer Twitter lexicon.
Yeah. Dannering will live on.
We need a beer Twitter dictionary, I think.
Ooh, I'll let you get on that one.
I don't think so. Leave that up to maybe Jeff Allworth or someone.
You can work on it on
a little more active.
You can work on it on. Oh, Jason Naughty would be a good beer Twitter dictionary producer. What do they call a person who makes dictionaries or adds words to the dictionary? A librarian? I don't know.
I don't know.
We'll get to that next week. All right, that's our show for this week. Episode 43 is in the books. 9 more episodes, and we'll have done a full year. Thanks, everyone, for sticking with us. Thank you for tuning in. Wherever you're listening, we are available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, Libsyn, and SoundCloud. If you like what we're doing, please leave us a rating and a review and share the podcast with your friends. Drop us a line over on podcast@brewbound.com if you'd like to be featured or if you just want to share your thoughts. Thank you to our audio team, our guest, Nancy Palmer, and to all of our big, beautiful listeners out there in beer world. Catch us next week for episode 44. Until then, cheers.
Cheers.
Happy 4th.